Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read. It's episode 39 and I'm Pip Adam. In this episode I speak with Helen Lundorf about, what do we talk about? We talk about lots. The sort of overriding premise is that we get together to talk about Derek Jarman's Sketchbooks, which is I think a relatively recent book. It's a publication of, it's a magnificent publication. It's just all these full colour reproductions of pages from Derek Jarman's visual diaries, which are just incredible. Derek Jarman was a filmmaker, but also a visual artist and a theatre designer as well. So yeah, it's a magnificent book. Derek Jarman's writing is just fantastic, and I feel very grateful to Helen for introducing it to me. Now, Helen, why or how may you have heard of Helen before? You may have heard of Helen because of her magnificent 2012 collection of poetry, which is called The Comforter and was published by Serif Press. You may know her as a teacher of creative writing. She's also a teacher of creative process, including journaling. But you may be hearing her name a little bit at the moment because she has just published her second book, which is called Write to the Centre. Write to the Centre is this magnificent mix of personal reflection, personal exploration, and I don't know, guidance into how one might start a journal of your own or how you might integrate journaling into your creative process. It's not unlike sketchbooks, has beautiful reproductions of some of the pages out of Helen's journals over the years. It's a magnificent book. I can't recommend it highly enough. So that is Write to the Centre. Helen has two events coming up in the near future that you might be interested in getting along to. This Saturday, which is the 29th of October at the Palmerston North Library, there's going to be a celebration and launch of Write to the Centre. That's at 4:30 this Saturday, the 29th of October at Palmerston North Library. The other event that's coming up is in Wellington. It's an event called Glue Sticks and Words, and Helen will appear with Mariah McMillan and David Merritt. And that's November 20th, and it starts at 2 o'clock, and it's at Thistle Hall. So, there are some notes on our show page, which is betterreadnz.wordpress.com. That's betterread, RE-A-D-NZ.wordpress.com. And you will also find us on Twitter, and you'll also find us on Facebook. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy the episode. I really enjoyed talking to Helen. I always enjoy talking to Helen. And, today was no exception. It was magnificent to sort of talk a little bit about creating and talk a little bit about some of our creative heroes. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the episode. Thanks. Okay, so hello. My name's Pip Adam and I am here with Helen Lundorf. How are you, Helen?
I'm good, thank you, Pip.
That's very good. We're in your, what do you call this room?
Sleep out.
This is the sleep out. It's magnificent. It's there's some beautiful pictures on the wall and it smells really nice and yeah, there's lots of books and stuff around. Is this where you mainly work?
Yeah. I can get the internet out here. Woohoo. So I can do my work there and my fiddling around creative work in here too.
Yeah, it's a really nice space.
And sometimes I have a sneaky nap because my family thinks I'm working, but there's a bed, so make the most of it.
It's a perfect office. Yeah. That sounds really good. You got some painting out there.
Yeah.
There's a big fat journal over there.
Yep.
That looks
awesome. Journaling happens in here.
I like that a lot. Right, so today we are going to talk about Derek Jarman's sketchbooks.
Yay!
I know, I'm super excited actually. Can you talk a little bit about why we chose this book?
Yes. So this book came out pretty recently, the last year or the year before, and I was very excited because Derek Jarman is one of my creative heroes and has been for a long time, and I'm a bit of a completist when it comes to him, and I think I pretty much own everything that's written by him or about him, and I love his journals, and I reread them each year, and this one... his other journals are written, his written diaries, but this one, this new one, is very beautiful art coffee table book, and it has facsimiles of his journal pages in it, and also lovely essays, short essays written by people who worked with him and were in his creative community. And it's just such a beautiful book. It adds, if you're interested in Derek Jarman, it adds a lot to the experience of him as an artist.
Did you first come to him through, I first came to him through film, and it wasn't until I got to know you that I realised, you know, that the writing was such a huge part. How did you arrive at Derek Jarman?
The Smiths.
Pardon?
The Smiths.
Yay! Thank you, Marcy.
Yeah. In 1986, he made three music videos for The Smiths. He was commissioned by Rough Trade. The Smiths were anti-music video. They didn't want music videos made. That's why there's not many of their music. But Morrissey liked Derek Jarman, and he was being a bit of a prima donna and was like, well, if Derek Jarman will do them, then maybe we'll conscience it. And, of course, probably thinking that Derek Jarman wouldn't. But Derek Jarman said, okay. And he made he made Panic, The Queen Is Dead, and the other one that's escaped my mind. And they're amazing. They're beautiful. They're shot in Super 8. Have you seen them?
I don't think I have.
Oh, after this you have to go watch them.
I will Google them.
Yeah, so they're shot in... when you think about 1986, I mean, like, Duran Duran, you know, Culture Club. Think of, like, Duran Duran, like, in white suits on jet boats. And you can kind of see why, or, like, Spandau Ballet's gold, you know, and all this sort of nightclub scene, and everyone wearing gold suits, and... you know, it was all kind of hyper-polished and a bit naff. I mean, I love 80s pop music, so I'm not dissing that at all, but that highly manufactured, wealth-oriented kind of thing, which the Smiths were very against. So I think the music videos of Derek Jarman made for the Smiths are so amazing when you think of that context. Because they're shot in Super 8, they're really rough. They are shot... in abandoned urban spaces, like an abandoned factory, and sort of almost like apocalyptic looking places, which I find really beautiful. But and the women in the music videos are so strong and beautiful. In the Queen Is Dead video, I just remember my mind was blown by those videos, absolutely blown, because it was just like some portal to a whole other universe, which I didn't understand, but I instantly loved. And yeah, the woman in the Queen Is Dead video, she's got like a boyish short hair style, kind of like a quiff, a bit like Morrissey. And she's wearing the bottom half of a really crazy wedding dress or ball dress. It's white with lots of layers of tulle and no top and Doc Martens, and she's just running around these urban landscapes, and she just looks really tough and fully confident. And the fact she's got no top on is kind of, it's not about her being titillating, she's just being fierce. And I don't know, it just blew my mind. And then I was like, who made those? Found out who made them, and then just got deeply, deeply obsessed very quickly about, segued off, you know, the Smiths into Derek Jarman. And the first film of his I watched was Jubilee, which is the punk movie. Yeah, and he calls that movie a fantasy documentary, which is such a funny term, because what the hell does that mean? But, it really encapsulates all of his films, really, fantasy documentary, because in one sense he's trying to capture, like, queer culture, the elements of English history that he loves, this aesthetic world that he loves, but I can see how he thinks it's documentary in that way, because he's capturing something of his life that he understands really well and means a lot to him. But there's so much fantasy as well. I mean, it's really, all of his films are total parallel universes.
And like, he was where do you think, like, I mean, because everything I read about him sort of says to me that
there were the theatre pieces, and there was some collaboration, and then there was the film, and then there was the writing as well. And I just wonder, like, how am I going to phrase this? What do you think motivates someone to move across genre like that?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't expect you to get inside his mind, but no. I mean, you know, why would someone not sit and say, okay, I'm a filmmaker, that's what I am, or I'm a theatre maker, or I'm a writer? What do you think is the engine behind that?
That's such an important part of Derek Jarman as an artist, because he was sort of like anything he turned his hand to, even if it was his garden, he did with a real artist's eye, or like his sketchbooks and diaries. You know, they're not just boring notebooks, they're absolutely beautiful works of art in themselves. He came to film accidentally, because he went to art school first, and then he did a whole lot of theatre design work, like designing backdrops and costumes for ballets. But he was living, I think, on the South Bank of London in a big a warehouse apartment in the 70s, and fell into film because he wanted to, I think it was like a queer commune kind of, and he got a Super 8 camera and was just documenting the life of him and his flatmates with the artists around him, and then just fell in love with the medium, and then it just took off from there. But he was never a traditional filmmaker, like he never, it was never about a narrative, like writing a script in a narrative form as we understand it. He was always very much a visual artist in the way he approached filmmaking. He loved still lives and tableaus, and would sort of like almost write his films in a visual way first. And lots of people that worked with him talk about how when they went to talk to him about whether they would act in his film or make art for his film, he loved collaborating with people, and he loved people injecting their creativity into his projects. So I think he was just such a collaborative person, such a collage artist, such a bricolage artist, that what was made was almost immaterial. You know, for him it was like a communal, fun, challenging experience, and so it's almost like he didn't care what was made, so long as he got to hang out with other creative people and all kind of work together on this thing. Like, because Tilda Swinton was kind of one of his muses, and she said that there was always the whiff of the school play about Derek, which is so sweet. But it kind of, you can imagine, like, that school play, kind of, let's put on a play, and everyone dressing up in their mum's nighties in the backyard, you know. I think he created just an amazing family atmosphere on set, and I can't remember what your original question was, no, but I just raved on now.
I love it, because I mean, where it comes to next is because, you know, like, I've lived in the time that I've lived in, and I know that there have been amazing artistic communities in the past and stuff like that, but it does feel like punk maybe had quite a lot to do with it. You know, it seems like at that time there seemed to be, what I remember about it, like when people at my school were just getting together and starting a band, and, you know, and or getting together and making a zine, or getting together and putting on, I don't know what else we were doing. But it seemed that there wasn't a necessity to do things in a polished, perfect way. Kind of what you're talking about, that weird moment that I think I grew up in, where there was shiny, shiny new romantic, you know, sounded like, ping, you know, like it just sounded perfect. And then there was this other stuff going on. And I just wonder, and I don't, in some ways I feel like both those things come together in Jarman. You know, maybe like the polish and the beauty of, say, a still life or something, but also the, I will pick up the camera and I have permission to do this sort of thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Or
yeah, no, I definitely think he was heavily influenced by punk. I mean, he was slightly older than the, you know, when punk was happening in the mid to late 70s, and all those teenagers and young 20-somethings were coming up into punk. He was a little bit older, but he was certainly around all that, all the creative scenes, and highly influenced and amazed and mind blown by what happened, And I think he was just really fearless with his creativity as well. Like he was never controlling or it's going to be like this. He was always really open to whatever anyone could chuck at it. And he was always trying to push his collaborators as well. Like something in the book here, someone says that, you know, he would just film them all the time, even when they were just hanging out and having lunch or whatever. And it's like he was always hungry to capture some amazing human moment, even though it was probably a bit irritating. And someone else in the book, I can't remember who it is, talks about what sort of what you're saying, like the 70s, there was a lot of, maybe because it was easier to get the doll or get money for projects then, I'm not sure, but there was much more people, artists just living together and hanging out, and that empty time, that empty communal time, when you're rubbing shoulders with all these creative people, then all these amazing things can sprout out of that. And in our current environment, we don't have that so much anymore. So struggling to get by, and you know, have the cheap rents, and you know, like being on the dole's not really a life option. Oh, that's probably a good thing. I don't know. Anyway,
I don't know.
Yeah, in fact, our friend Mariah McMillan, she longs for that because we used to, you know, I've known Mariah since we were in our 20s, and at university there was a lot of like hanging out, just hanging out, cups of tea, and faffing around and playing around with stuff. And she quite often wistfully says to me, like, nobody even hangs out anymore. Can't we just hang out? Let's just, like, hang, you know, let's create that early 20s thing of just hanging out again. And, I mean, she's right. It's harder to do maybe as you get older, but also I think just our contemporary times.
And I think, you know, that's something I really noticed. Sorry, I'm totally segueing now, but, you know, it's something I've noticed at universities as well, you know, like, all of the spaces have become quite mall-like. You know, like, there's all this pressure on university students now. Like, if you don't pass, you don't get your student loan the next year. And, you know, and everybody's thinking vocationally and everyone's trying to get their degrees done so quickly and blah, blah, blah. And I just, I understand that some of that has possibly moved to the virtual world. You know, possibly some of the hanging out happens, you know, in social media maybe. Even saying social media makes me feel like the 47-year-old woman I am, but you know, like, but that idea of being able to video someone all day long, or being able to you know, say let's play, you know, it just seems to go, doesn't
the space.
It
yeah, I so agree with you. I mean, also the students work so hard, you know, like I've just been working on a paper at Massey and lots of them look so tired, and I would say, well, you know, were you at partying all weekend, sort of, hopefully? And they're like, no, I was working. I did a 12-hour shift at a cafe. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, because I remember, like, I didn't go to university. I left school and worked. But even in working, there was this weird thing where there was no casualization. You know, I had a job. I knew where my hours were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge gift. And I think a lot of the people I knew that were in bands and stuff, they had a job, but they knew when their hours were, and they knew that if they made rehearsal time Thursday at 5 o'clock, you know, they knew who would be able to make it and stuff. And I just, I don't know. And like, I just feel like that's what I think is quite important about your book, is that there does seem to be a little bit, and this is just my reading, so maybe wrong, but there does seem to be that element of play that you kind of advocated for in the book, you know, a little bit of even the fact that the exercises at the end of each chapter, they're called give it a go, like
give it a whirl,
Cheryl.
Splitting song.
Yeah. I like it. But yeah, I just wonder, do you think I don't know, like, going back to when you first started, what was it like for you? Like, did you start visually orientated in that you were one of the people who painted and did art and stuff like that, or were you more, was there a time when you were in a band, or was it always poetry, or was it, can you remember a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I talk about this a little bit in the introduction of Right to the Centre, but I got into punk at a really early age, about 12. First time I dyed my hair green was when
you're
I was 12.
Baby punk. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. That's so cool. It was just with food colouring, but you know.
Yeah, it's important.
Hey.
Wasn't everybody just with food colouring? I mean, good God. Well, Ginge and violet is actually, something I remember.
Yeah, ginge and violet. That stuff never washed out.
It sores.
Yeah, I have to ask my friend Brenda about this. My friend Brenda, who was a really amazingly peacock-like punk and had beautiful mohawks and stuff. But, like, before we had, you know, hair dye, we had all the normal colours of hair dye in the 80s, but you couldn't really get green or blue or hot pink or whatever, so you did have to resort to some pretty extreme means to get your hair those colours. And I'm pretty sure Brenda used some bizarre product from the pet shop, which was like something that you used to clean out fish tanks or something to dye your hair, either blue or green.
There were some crystals that you could...
You know about this from being a hairdresser.
I mean, you know, we used to use Jell-O, we used to use everything, but then Crazy Colour came out in London and you could, like, it was like black market. You'd be like,
smuggle it in.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
So you started, so you're early punk, you're 12 years old.
That's right. So 12, 13, 14, you know, those early teen years. I wasn't in a band, but I was... there was a real punk scene in New Plymouth, Taranaki Hardcore.
Yay.
And we had bands like Sticky Filth and Casualty and Toxic Avengers, and so I was kind of like a little baby punk band girl and used to go to those gigs and absolutely loved going right up the front and getting flung around and squashed by the big skinheads in their boots, and I was just this primal feral release for me. I loved it so much. Me and my friend Kylie Wardlaw, my high school friend, we started this zine called Vox Populi, which is Latin for a voice of the people. So embarrassing.
No, it's not.
Vox Populi. And we interviewed the local bands, and we interviewed bands from around the world too, like England and Germany. This is snail mail, you know, this is pre-internet, so I had to write those letters and stick those stamps on, and it was very lo-fi, and we made the zines just by literally cutting and pasting and then photocopying, and we did all the photocopying at school, actually, because we told the office lady it was like an English project, and we photocopied like 200 copies of this scene. She's like, you're very copying a lot. Yeah, it's for English. Yeah, English.
God, it's English.
So I guess that was a precursor to me playing. You use that word play. Playing with visual effects, and it sort of moved into my journals. And also, like, I always wanted to go to art school, but it kind of didn't happen. So I think that it was this way of me channeling the frustrated, wasn't allowed to go to art school thing, but just playing around in my journal. And it was always because, I mean, ironically, I've now written a book, which is really public, but because it's just the journaling practice is just for you, it doesn't matter if it's ugly or it doesn't succeed or it's a mess or it's self-indulgent or whatever, because only you see it, so you can really kind of play around and mess around and do whatever the hell you feel like doing.
Because it's one of my favorite things, I think it might be on your blog, that idea that you're on a panel maybe and someone said, if everyone died tomorrow and you're the only one here, would you keep writing? Yeah. And everyone else said, oh no, no. I really related to that, because I love the idea of I love the idea of writing back to ourselves. I really like that idea a lot.
Yeah. How about you, Pip? Would you keep writing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh,
yeah.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, I write so much that no one sees that I... Yeah, you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Like, me
just
too.
It's just my favourite thing. I like the noise it makes inside. Like, there's a special feeling, you know. And, yeah, I think it's my favourite thing when I think something's not for someone else. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
I know. So, yeah, I was on a panel... It was Manawatu writers, so it was me, Johanna, I'm going to out them. It's me, Johanna Aitchison, Tim Upperton, and Leonel Alvarado. And a member of the audience, actually, not the convener, asked that question, like, if you were the last person on Earth, would you write tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And I just happened to have the microphone, so I was like, yes, of course! of course I would. I mean, it's such a joy, writing. And expected a chorus of agreement, and then Johanna took the mic off me and went, hell no. What's the point? And then, yeah, and then the others agreed. And then Brian Woolpit was the convener, and he agreed as well. It's like, no, if no one's going to see it, like, what's the point? I guess it's like that Zen koan, eh? Like, the sound of one hand clapping. No, the wrong one. This, if a tree falls in the woods, does anyone hear it? That's the right one. Yeah, it's kind of like that. And so it's, to me, it's like, I don't care if nobody hears it.
Can you remember the time that it split off like that, where there was the zine that was kind of obviously for an audience, you know, and like in a very, it seems like in a very, what's the word I'm looking for? In a very literal way, you know, it was sort of a community, you know, and then there was the journaling that was for you.
Mm.
Like, can you, do you remember, was it a conscious choice? Did you go and buy a journal and think, this is my journal for this year? Or,
I've always journaled in blank books, never in those books with dates. And I think it was, this probably sounds a bit naff, but it was sort of like a way of safely becoming a creative person, because I desperately wanted to be a writer, desperately wanted to be an artist of any kind, wanted to have a creative life. And it was almost like putting on, you know, the clothing, not the clothing, like trying on, I was trying on that role before, you know, when I wasn't yet a published writer or whatever. It was kind of like, oh, well, I can be this writer and this artist and this creative person in the confines of this journal, and I can, it's a good outlet for it, and I can try on different points of view and try on different opinions, and I can experiment with writing. And yeah, so it was like a real sort of testing ground. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, totally. Mm. I really relate. I think it's such a great, I don't know, that's such a great way of explaining it. So what do you think it means, like, when you think about Jarman's book here?
Yeah.
And also his two, well, there are more, aren't there?
Yeah.
I'm a bit obsessed with this one at the moment.
Smiling in Slow Motion.
Yes.
Isn't that a great title?
Such a great title, man.
And Modern Nature is the other one.
Modern Nature is so great as well. So what is it, were those published in his lifetime?
I might get that wrong, but I think one was and one wasn't. One was after he died. Yeah, the second one was after he died.
So but I just wonder, what is it to take that work that is for oneself and then to publish it? What do you think, I mean, like, we can talk a bit about what that's been like for you, but I mean, to get, in the case of Derek Jarman, you know, like, where he leaves this incredible legacy of himself and his collaborative work, and then, but also we get this incredible gift of, you know, his most personal, well, not most personal, but his, you know, we get to see the working out and the trying on.
It's intimate stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with him, because he got HIV, he was HIV positive and then died of AIDS, and he was really left wing, he was really anti-Thatcher in the 80s, he was very out and proud and into queer politics, and I think partially his, those, not the sketchbooks, but the other two books, just this a beautiful distillation of that queer history, which was really powerful because I mean, he's living the hell of being HIV positive, and before that happens, there's lots of wonderful things about queer history, like in Modern Nature there's lots of, is it called cottaging?
Oh yes,
I was gonna say fromaging, but that's not right, that's cheese. Cottaging in Hampstead Heath. I think that's the right term, I'm sure. Listeners will tell us if it's not. I've never done it, so I don't know.
Correct us on our late sexual. Yeah.
There's lots of lovely accounts of him cottaging in Hampstead Heath, which is, you know, picking up beautiful young men and having a shag behind a tree or something. Why am I talking about that? Oh, just queer history.
Yeah.
He's so honest. I mean, you know, he writes about that stuff in such detail, and it's fascinating and kind of beautiful just how honest he is. And yeah, and then, I mean, even when he fell in love with Keith Collins, who he called Hinny Beast, is his true love, who now lives in Prospect Cottage in Dungeness and still caretakes it. They had an open relationship, so they both went off with other partners, and that, and he writes all about that. So yeah, all that queer history is really beautiful. All that creative process stuff is really interesting. And then, you know, I love gardening, so he writes all about his garden at Dungeness, and I love all that side of it too. So I think there's just so much, he's just offering the reader so much, and even though they're his personal diaries, there's just such a richness of material. It feels like such a treat. You don't feel like you're just reading someone going, "Dear diary, they went to Sainsbury's and won another film award." You know, it's a full, juicy, interesting life.
Because that's what I found really interesting about, I'm not a huge gardener, but even those, it was almost like, what's the word I'm looking for? It was almost like a inventory, you know, today I bought this, today I planted that, today, you know, like, and I guess it made me think a little bit of the Warhol diaries, which are kind of, you know, which were kind of started to be, you know, I think the legend is that they were started because his accountant wanted him to start writing down everything he spent. But there's something so much in the sort of concentration on a task or something, eh? Like, there's something so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because in Right to the Centre, I talk about lists. Because to create the chapters, I put all of my diaries in chronological order and then read them in chronological order, which is such a weirdo thing to do. Nobody ever does that. I mean, you might dip into your diaries, but you don't, like, read them like a narrative from, you know, 1990 to 2015. It's really odd and quite painful, weird. But I was looking for anything I did a lot, or anything, any patterns or whatever. And something I certainly did a lot was lists. Just you saying, like, the inventory of Andy Warhol's diary of things he'd bought, or Derek Jarman's plants and plantings. And I seem to do lists a lot. And yeah, I think it's about paying attention. Sometimes if you're going through a busy or challenging time, it's just a really quick way to grab hold of something of the day, to jot down something that you did or you had or consumed or whatever. Just paying attention.
That had never occurred to me. You just said something that hadn't occurred to me, is that you, some of your memories are physical now, aren't they? Like, I mean, just this idea that when I think back to 1990, I'm just very fuzzy time, but when I think back to 1990, I'm kind of like, maybe, you know, everything's contestable, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and it only takes one person to say to me, "Oh no, you fucking did this." And I'm like, "Oh, I must have," you know. But what is that? What, I guess you can't compare though, can you? Because you've never not had them.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a nice gift to give yourself.
Yeah, it's really, it's, when I read them chronologically to make Right to the Centre, there was so much in there that I had completely forgotten. And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's right, that happened, that was weird," or, "Oh yeah, or that person who is no longer in my life, where did they go?" Well, you know, all those sort of things. And so I guess, yeah, if I hadn't written it down, I would have forgotten. Maybe that's okay though. I mean, do you want to remember everything?
Wouldn't mind. But I guess that's a really good, I don't know, like, since I've read your book and sort of been thinking about it in sort of read the Derek Jarman stuff, and that I have been thinking about how it's a very good argument for starting now, you know what I mean? I was just thinking, actually, you know, there's, I mean I can't go back to 1990, but it's quite a good I don't know, like, it's quite a nice argument for starting a little bit of recording now, kind of, eh?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. And I also think if you're a creative person, because Derek Jarman seemed to start a new book for each creative project, and a lot of the facsimiles in the sketchbooks relate to his films and his creative projects. But with my journals, everything's intermingled, and it's how I like to work. It's how I like to work. So I might have like a few pages where it's like, "Oh, this is what I've been up to, blah, 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 boring life stuff." And then I might have some poem drafts, or then I might have some reading notes. Do you know what I mean? So in my journals, everything's just chucked in together. And for me, that works really well, because that's how I want my art to be.
Mm.
I want my art, sounds so pretentious. I want my creative work to always be very integrated with my whole life. I don't want it to be over there on a shelf. Do you know what I mean? I want to,
oh, yes.
Yeah. So I want it to be some sort of embodiment of my values and who I am as a person and the choices I make. And so for me, having my creative process stuff, reading notes and drafts and first attempts, and alongside the daily, the lists and the daily notes and all that sort of thing, helps me with that integration.
Because that's another thing I was thinking when I was reading, especially the sketchbook, like you may have it as well as a teacher at a university, but we're often wondering what research might look like in a creative writing department, you know,
right.
what when someone does a PhD in creative writing, what are they adding to the research discipline, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And I was thinking that with these sketchbooks, it's an amazing, it's such a practice-led kind of, sorry, I should start writing a RFP or whatever those things are called for university, but I mean, I was just thinking, like, it's another way that these are such a gift is that you can see the thinking that leads to decisions, creative decisions sometimes, like,
mm.
very obliquely in these, like, I mean, it's not like, you know, I went here and then I did this.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, like, I mean, you know, I'm just looking at a page at the moment and it's got Polaroids of people and kind of you can start to see that the way they look, you know, they're sitting in a certain position on the page and then there's some sketches over here and
mm.
I don't know, like to see.
Yeah, because that's how creativity works, isn't
mm.
it? It's sort of like you chuck a whole lot of things together and you let them all mellow and then you hope. So it's like things that you're reading and external influences and also your life as you're living it. And your senses and your history and wider history and whichever particular area you're interested in, you're looking at it from that point of view, and then it marinates and then you're hoping that something original comes out of it that's yours that you can offer to the world. But it's never a clean neat process, is it? It's like these Derek Jarman's sketchbooks here, it's kind of not necessarily linear or tidy or methodical. It's more like Bill Manhai taught me the word bricolage. I this is a funny story. I did a Whanganui School of the Arts summer school course with Bill Manhai when I was 15 because my mum was worried I was going off the rails. So she enrolled me, and I reminded Bill about it, and he was like, oh, that was you, that random teacher, because the rest of the class was, like, middle-aged women. But on that course, he taught us the concept of bricolage, which is sort of similar to collage, but it's not, like, paper. It's sort of like random elements, throwing
mm.
random
mm.
elements
mm.
together to see what can happen. And obviously that really seeded in my brain quite deeply. I love the term and love the notion. And I think you can see that Derek Jarman does that in the sketchbooks. Just
mm.
throws lots of things at an idea. And then, yeah. And also, because he records his creative process, just you talking about the validity of it in terms of the academic world, it's only because of this capturing of the process that once the thing is made, the book or the film or whatever, that you get the richness of looking back at how it came about, and you can sort of have a bit of a sense of everything that went into it. And it would be a shame, you know, for that not to exist in terms of his films.
Yeah, because because that is the other thing, I guess, is that I often think about with him is that idea of the contemporary, you know, like of sort of even though there are all sorts of moments of history in a lot of his work and stuff like that, but they really are a product of their time. And
mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, like, these also offer a bit of a roadmap that way as well, don't they? Like,
mm-hmm.
they sort of add some sort of contextualizing stuff around it. Like, I mean, through the sketchbooks, there are some, I think, oh gosh, now I'll probably get it wrong, but I think through here I was seeing kind of, like, newspaper headlines and
mm.
anti-Thatcher stuff, and,
yeah.
you know, and just that idea that, you know, like, there's, I think, what am I trying to say? I think what I'm trying to say is that to get these unofficial histories are really quite important.
Yeah, the incidental stuff. Yeah, at the time it was that day's newspaper, but then in 20 years' time it's context, isn't it? Yeah.
And also just that thing that I remember a very official story of all that coming through, you know, and it wasn't until you sort of, you know, especially in the slowness that media was in my world, sort of in those, in the 80s and, you know, early 90s, you know, and I guess, you know, this, I don't know, it's such an interesting idea of sort of, yeah, that democratization of recording, you know, like it's like, this is my version of today, you know, this is the official version and this is my version. I don't know, I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think his films are, apart from a few of them, like the Shakespeare and Caravaggio and the one about Wittgenstein, or maybe even that one a little bit, but most of them are pretty non-narrative, non-linear narrative. And arguably they're, especially these days with our short attention spans, they can be a challenging watch because there's no neat, tidy narrative arc or whatever. So with his films, I don't know how you experience them, but I find you kind of have to sit in front of them and just experience them like a moving piece of art rather than as a film in the traditional sense, and let yourself sort of slowly get sucked into this Derek Jarman world. Because I also experience them as sort of outside normal time, sort of similar to... Like, we've talked about Virginia Woolf's The Waves and what she does with time, how the emotional and felt world of those characters is sort of outside linear time. And I think his films can often seem like that. They're sort of over here. There's the normal world and normal time, and then there's this Derek Jarman experience of time. And in here, Howard Suley, who was his gardening friend. He's an amazing nature photographer who does a lot of photography to this day for The Guardian in the UK. And there's a beautiful book called Derek Jarman's Garden, which Howard Suley took the photographs for. And Howard Suley talks about how hanging out with Derek was like that. There was something about his character where time would not seem to pass in the normal way, or time would drop away. And so he'd think, I'll just pop down and do a couple of hours of hanging out in the garden with Derek, and then he would look at his watch and it would have been like 8 hours, but the light didn't seem to have changed and no time seemed to have passed. And yeah, I mean, obviously I idealise Derek Jarman because he's one of my creative heroes, but I just love the notion that there was something kind of seductive and special about him, that he pulled people into his world and time fell away when you're hanging out with him. So yeah.
Oh god, I was just remembering that Wittgenstein movie.
Yeah,
I remember.
It's pretty weird, eh?
I so loved it. Oh my god, I'm just remembering how much I loved it.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Oh, sorry, I'm just gonna have a moment remembering how much I loved it. Sorry. I was just thinking about how wonderful it was, that idea of time, and I was just thinking about how this is very sad, but I was just thinking about how the end of his life, you know, what an odd temporal space to be in that must have been, you know, like
facing down his own death,
acutely aware of mortality. Like, I guess we're all aware of mortality, but in just such a full-on kind of way.
Yeah, a beautiful thing is how it's sort of like a classic case of rage against the dying of the light, isn't it? Because he created right up until he physically could not do anything more. And then also in the sketchbooks, it talks about how even when he was like blind, pretty much semi-blind and atrophying in his bed, he was still really aesthetic. Like, he would complain about the way his room looked, or packaging on his food or whatever. You know, right to the end, he had this big opinions about his aesthetics just in the hospital room, which is so lovely. And yeah, so like the film Blue, which was his last film, has a blue screen, and it's the blue of the French artist Yves Klein. there's a name for the blue, it's gone out of my head. It's a very bright, vivid blue, and it's because Derek was losing his sight, and the sound of the film is, it's all about his experience of losing his health and losing his sight and all the indignities of losing your strength. I mean, how amazingly courageous is that to make that piece of art? Just phenomenal, really.
It's just magnificent, hey? Like, I remember seeing it, I get confused about when things came out, but I remember seeing it in a theatre and just the way, oh God, yeah, it was just, it was the most, one of the most amazing experiences I think I've ever had.
Yeah.
You know, like the way that blue kind of washed over people, you know, like, and just, yeah it was pretty fucking amazing.
Do you remember coming out of the cinema and your vision being really weird for
yep.
ages? Just, yeah, this bright blue screen.
Like, oh, people.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it sort of does something to your eyesight. So I think all the colours are inverted or something. So you look at yellow and it's black.
Oh, of course.
Everything's really trippy for a while when you've seen that film anyway, on a big screen.
Oh, man. I don't remember it specifically, but I do remember just feeling very wrong. You know, like, just
yeah.
like, can we just wait for a
yeah.
little bit longer?
I don't know if he knew that would happen, but it's kind of a nice side effect of
yeah.
the film.
It's really magnificent.
Mm.
Can you talk a little bit about how Right to the Centre came about, your book?
Oh, sure. So I sometimes teach journaling as part of other teaching, sometimes at university and sometimes in like private classes or day retreats or whatever. I always take some of my journals along, so
mm-hmm.
I can say, this is my theory and here's my practice, here's what I do, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not just all talk and here's what I do. And people were so lovely, about my journals and would say, you should write a book, I would totally read it, you know, this is, and which was really nice, but part of me, and I did listen to that obviously, but then the other part of me was like, oh no, it's too self-indulgent, it's too like, who the hell do I think I am? I'm not Derek Jarman or Virginia Woolf or some fabulous artist, I'm just some woman. So there are a whole lot of things getting in the way. Also, it's just very intimate and personal, so it's just that kind of fear.
Mm.
The fear was huge. So I kind of threw it into the hands of, I should pause at this point and say, two people, Helen Heath and Sarah Lang,
mm.
were just so amazing and supportive. I think I mentioned it to them years ago, a long time ago, and both of them were like, yes, do it, and sometimes one or the other of them would say, when are you going to do that book? Or, all right, when do that book? I want to read that book. It was so nice when your friends do that, because often you're writing just in a void, nobody cares, you know. So to have friends around going, come on, do it. So I want to thank them, because it wouldn't happen without their support. But then last year, I kind of felt like thinking and dreaming about this project was getting in the way of me like finishing my second volume of poetry and doing other creative things. Like, it was starting to become a bit of a block.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, it's time to either do it or not and move on. So I applied to the Earl Trust for a grant for this project, and to me, in my head, it was like, okay, I'm gonna throw it into the hands of fate, and if I get the grant, it's meant to be, and I'm gonna do the book and then I can move on. And if I don't get the grant, it wasn't meant to be, I can forget it and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my thing. And I got the grant, much to my astonishment, because I was still at the stage of like, it's such a self-indulgent book, nobody's going to understand what I'm talking about. But I got the grant. And it's a time-bound grant, so you have to complete the project within a year of receiving it.
This is a good idea.
Yeah. So I had to get it done this year, which was probably good, otherwise I would have just put it off forever.
Yeah, and kind of like, instead of, this is this thing, I'm always interested in this word self-indulgent, because I always worry that I am that, and but weirdly, everyone I've talked to knows exactly what you're talking about.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone that, because you know, like, I mean, there's a real, I was going to say buzz, but that makes me sound like an advertising executive. But, you know, like, in my group of friends, a lot of people are reading it and reading it in, like, one day and, you know,
goodness.
Like, just astounded with it. And I think...
So nice.
Do you think... I mean, I don't know. Do you have any opinions on that? Like, how when we write... Actually, Patricia Grace was talking about it at the Māori Writers Hui a couple of weeks ago. Like, that idea that... if we write true to ourselves, whatever that means, true, using inverted commas, but if we write kind of, you know, the things that we think make us different, possibly that's when art is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I do. I do think vulnerable art has a quality about it which makes people maybe a little kinder and more receptive, because if they can, so as long as the writing's good and the quality is good alongside it being vulnerable, it's not just like letting out a vein, you know. I think people meet you, they meet you with the level of vulnerability you've offered. Do you know what I mean? So,
oh yeah. Because that's a really good point, actually, because I guess reading, in a way, is a bit of a vulnerability as well, isn't it? Like, to sort of open your mind to somebody else's voice, I guess, or to look at somebody else's,
yeah.
You know, like, art can often...
It's the other half of the conversation, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
yeah. And what I should say about the book is that there are some pages in here that I think are quite ugly and clunky-looking and amateurish-looking. But I was, so there are a lot of pages that are not in the book, which are nicer and more attractive. But because I really wanted to be true to all the stuff I was saying in here about playing and experimenting and letting yourself make ugly, awkward work. So I, you know, there's a lot of crap art in here because I don't want to present something that is all shiny, shiny, picture perfect and pretend that my journals or I as a creative playing around person are something that they're not. So not so much the writing, but some of the visual stuff is quite cringy for me to look at when I look through the books, like, oh my god, it's like so hideous. But I felt like I had to be true and give a real spectrum of everything that was in the journals, not just all the journal pages that I felt were really aesthetically successful.
I think I'm always interested in stuff that is on that tipping point, you know what I mean? Like that there's something that really awakens in me when I see something and I just think, oh yeah, there's something, you know, it's not... What's the word I'm looking for? It's not ringing. I guess it's that word of polish again, maybe, or craft, or I don't know. Like, there's just, I don't know. Like, there's something so intriguing when something's a little bit open for, you know what I mean? Like, it isn't complete.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's what I'm thinking about. I don't know.
I think so too, because I know exactly what you mean. It's it could fall over either side of successful or hideously ugly or whatever, and I'm really interested in that line as well. And when I'm reading, because I love these kind of books, like the Derek Jarman one, and I want to say I love my own book, but you know, like books that document the creative process is what I'm getting at. So I often get books out of the library that are writers' journals or sketchbooks or books about journaling or whatever. But the ones that are perfect, they sort of make me feel dead inside. because who's perfect all the time? And that person might be an incredibly accomplished artist, but there's nothing for me there. Do you know what I mean? It's nothing for... us talking about vulnerability earlier, it's not much vulnerability there. They're just showing off the very shiniest, best work. It's sort of a jazz hands kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit how the blog ties into this? Because I was just thinking you have at times and are current, you know, like there's, you've had amazing blogs and have an amazing blog. I always think of that as kind of a little bit ephemeral and moving and shifting as well. Can you talk a little bit about how technology kind of plays in, you know, to go from, you
paper.
Know, like glue sticks and scissors and that sort of thing to, you know, like something that can be made quite shiny, you know?
Mm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Is the blog dead, by the way? Like,
I don't think so.
I keep reading these opinion pieces like, blogging is dead.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm confused.
Or like the market killed blogging because of ads and... Google Analytics and also like what's that acronym TLDR. Like, apparently our attention spans are so short that if you write more than kind of 100 words, no one's going to read it. I don't know.
Oh my God.
But I mean, I know I still read a lot of blogs. I have Blog Lovin', which is a blog app, and I have, I don't know, about 50 blogs that I read. So yeah, my blogging's been a bit intermittent, but I was an early adopter of blogging. I think I started my first blog in 2005, and it was called Stripey Sock Studio, which is endearingly naff now, but it was a different time.
I was just thinking, it kept me alive through the birth of my child. Aww. That sounds dreadful. I felt so isolated, and I used to read it. Has she put something new up?
Yeah.
You know, and I think, I don't know, like, I loved it. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. So 2005,
yeah.
Stripey Socks.
So, but I just remember when I had that blog, because, you know, social media wasn't around yet, as we know it, and people sometimes have websites, but blogging was pretty new, and the fact I had a blog was like a point of conversation. Like, I remember going to gatherings, parties, whatever, and people would go, oh my God, you have a blog. I read your blog. Like, it was just, you know, different days, the pioneering days of the internet. So that was sometimes odd, because I felt like I was, when I was making that blog, it was sort of playing around with an online version of what I was doing in my journals. When I was writing that blog, I was always writing to people like you, my friends and comrades and people who would understand me and stuff. So sometimes when people outside that sphere would go, oh, I read your blog, I would be like, oh my God, no, don't. It's just part of getting used to online life, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
But no, I think they're really different. There's something about the... I still love blogging and reading blogs. I have a mixed relationship with social media. It's just sort of like a necessity nowadays, isn't it, if you're a writer, to have a social media presence. And sometimes it can be lovely and sometimes not so much. I think I've talked about this on the bookseller's blog. I did a post about this a few years ago, but the thing I dislike the most about social media as a writer is when you work out that you've been rejected from something.
Oh yeah.
Because all around you, your friends are going, woohoo, I'm going to do this. And you're like, oh, okay. And it's ironic because, like, back in the olden days, you know, the Little House on the Prairie days, no, back in, what am I getting at? Used to get rejection letters in the mail. Mm-hmm. Used to get, you know, a letter from Landfall of Sport that was like, dear blank, and someone had scrawled your name. Rejected again, sucks to be you, love, Kate Camp, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Didn't say love. That's okay. Why should she? Okay, anyway, so you would get a rejection letter, and it was always kind of cool. It was like building up your writer's stripes. But ironically, the easier it has become to communicate, the worse the communication has become around rejection, to the point when often now journals or anthologies or whatever you're applying for, or grants or whatever, they don't even bother telling you at all, because emailing is too hard, apparently. So you find out, you know, you can often work out that you didn't get something because all around you there's this fireworks going off on Facebook of people going, yay, oh my God, I got in, I'm so happy. And you're like, I just want to die now.
Yeah.
And because it's social media, and because you are happy for your friends, you have to go, yay, while you're still processing your own pain.
I remember once finding out I didn't get into something because I saw it in a bookshop.
Right, yeah.
I was like, so much
time had elapsed, it had like, been published.
Oh, it's published.
Yeah.
And then I'm such a narcissist. Or something, I don't know, an optimist. I thought, maybe I am published in here and they just didn't.
Yeah, comment. They forgot to tell me. I'll just have a look at the contributors. Oh no, my name's not there. Okay.
Oh my God. What a fucking nightmare. Dear. Oh God. Yeah, so
But anyway, yeah, I think making tangible stuff, especially in this online age, is all the more special, which is why I think Zine Fest is going off. Because,
yeah.
I mean, Zine Fest never died. Zines never died. But zines seem to be having a bit of a renaissance at the moment. And I think it's that beautiful analogue thing. Like, I think it's, you know, we're so saturated in the online stuff. The fact that people are working with paper, with their hands and photocopiers and cutting things out, it's not that it's quaint. It's not like it's endearingly old school. It's more just like a beautiful tangibility.
Because it's just, I think that's, I went to this amazing place in Melbourne. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like a, it was down in a dungeon. It was underneath a train station. It was underneath a train station. And they had one photocopier there. They might have had two photocopiers. And then just lots of desks. And people would make zines there, photocopy them, and then put them for sale. Oh. And then if they sold, the money would go back to the person whose zine it was. And while I was there, I met a woman who she was homeless, and she'd made some zines, and she was like, you should buy my zine, this is my zine. And I bought them, and it was just, I don't know, like, it just felt so it did feel amazing. And I don't think it was nostalgia. I don't think that's what it was about. I think, because that's the other thing, is that the technology as far as zines goes is, you know, like, I mean, I remember the clunky, I remember the Gestetner. That's what I remember.
Oh, the smell.
The smell was so nice. But, you know, that thing where you would roll it through and, you know, that was your newsletter or something like that. And I just think, I don't know, I think it's pretty special.
Remember carbon paper?
I loved carbon paper.
I used to write, I would sometimes get some from someone's dad's office or something. Sometimes write letters, and it would blow my mind that I could, like, write the letter, send one copy off, and keep one copy.
I could keep my letter. It's amazing. It's wild.
Yeah.
So now that you've finished this book, which is exciting and is wonderful. Whoops. And I think I snapped something. sorry about your house. What? I don't know. You can take a break, obviously.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. You have my permission, because I, you know, do everything. But what? Do you have any idea what is coming next?
Really want to finish my second volume of poetry.
Yep.
I have a lot of poems. I'm just a bit of a perfectionist, so I keep chucking them out and, you know, trying to write new ones. But I think that shouldn't be too far away now that I've got this book out of the way. I love, like Derek Jarman, I love collaborating. Mm. So I think... I would love to do some more collaborating with other artists, and I'm not 100% sure what that might look like yet, but I'm really open to suggestions and ideas. I've got a bit of an idea for a novel that's started to congeal in my brain. So that's interesting, because I haven't done much fiction in the last decade or so I don't know if anything will come of that, but it's interesting that tendril has appeared. So yeah,
because your collaboration stuff's been amazing, eh? Like those amazing, that Manawatu, what was that called? Was
Black
that Black River?
River?
Was incredible.
I was really proud of that. So that was a collaboration with some local printmakers. It was poets and printmakers responding to the Manawatu River. And some people, it went one way or the other. So you either got a poem first or a print first. I worked with Rachel Garland, who's a printmaker from Whanganui. She's an amazing artist. And she got my poem first, which was called Mudlark. So she made her print from my poem in our case. Yeah. Another collaboration I did, was it last year or the year before? Can't remember. Was with Rob Thorne, who's a Ngā Taonga Pōru artist, and we did it was such cool fun. It was because he mixes, because he's got sort of punk roots as well, so he mixes up Ngā Taonga Pōru and loop pedal, and we did a sound collaboration. So it was my words and silence and his Ngā Taonga Pōru and some loops of both of us. And it was really funny, because me being a stressy Virgo, Rob's quite loose. I love that about him. He's like a pirate. He's like, yeah, we'll be fine. I'm more like slightly, I'm not uptight, controlly, but a little more like, maybe we should sort of work out what we're doing. anyway, all these life things happened, and we didn't end up having our devising / rehearsal till the day of the performance. Can you imagine? So so I went to around to his house. I think the performance was at 7 that night, and I went to his house like at 2 in the afternoon. And I'll be honest, by that time, he'll laugh at this, but, you know, I was pooping my pants because it was that night, and we had exchanged some words and had a bit of a chat, but we had nothing, essentially. but it's that cool thing sometimes when you leap into the void, eh, and it turns out okay. So I went over to his house, and we just mucked around and played with some different ideas, and it sort of, the rehearsal devising time ended, and I was like, whoa, I think it's going to be okay. And then we did it that night, and because we'd only had one session, we didn't 100% stick to what we'd done that day, obviously, but I think it worked. And I think because we were both prepared to just kind of be in the moment, and because we're old friends, we've got a good understanding of each other, so we pretty much were facing each other. We were sort of side onto the audience and facing each other, and it was like some kind of instinctual thing took over. So I could just tell when he was about to do something, and so I would just leave off, and then there might be some quiet, and then I could tell when he wanted me to do something, so I would. I don't know. It was just a very special experience.
There is something so magnificent about collaboration like that, eh?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's so...
When you trust everybody.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. It's just incredible. And yeah. I do wonder, I don't know. I hate saying things about generations because I don't think everyone's exactly the same and everyone's experience is exactly the same. But it's something I'm really grateful for is that, you know, right from the beginning of my teenagehood, you know, when I started to listen to The Jam and learn about socialism and that kind of thing, you know, like, that idea of sort of coming together, you know, like, the all of us can do something that one of us can't, or something weird that all of us can do something that all of us can't, or something, I don't know, like, that wonderful thing that there's an extra thing that comes to the party when there's two of you. It's like, there's this third thing that neither of you could have created it, but also you two together couldn't have created it. You know what I mean? Like,
I absolutely
something,
do.
Yeah. I love it.
And
that's
why I love collaborating so much, because I feel like the work is invariably stronger with more voices. You end up somewhere you couldn't have imagined. You usually learn something along the way. And then also there's more chance to surprise yourself when you're collaborating.
Yeah.
Like, if it's just you, it's like, oh, me again.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah,
oh, good.
So work with other people, you can surprise yourself and they can surprise you. And sometimes you get stretched in directions you might not be comfortable with, but it's really good for your creative growth. Oh, it's just win-win, really.
And that idea, that thing you're saying about, like, the sort of jumping into the void stuff as well, you know, that, I don't know, like, there's something amazing about risk. I don't know, it's quite incredible. And that's what I think is great about your book as well, is that, you know, like, it's I hate that word brave because it always, I don't know why, I don't know, ambitious, I don't know, there's something about
why does that make me feel uncomfortable too.
Though
when people say it's so brave or you're so brave, I always, what I hear is deluded.
Yeah What I hear is shouldn't have done that. Like, someone said, yeah, I had a period in my life where people were saying, that was brave.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, fuck, I'm really fucked up. You know, like, oh, shouldn't have done that. But I don't know, like, I do think that there is something about risk and about, I don't know. It sounds, sometimes the best stuff comes out of me when I'm terrified. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe terror is too much of a block. But,
yeah.
You know, just that sort of doing and, you're doing, maybe that's what it is.
I think also, like, this book is, it's kind of not very New Zealand. Like, you could almost classify it as a self-help book, which makes me a little bit feeling like I've got hives. But, well, exactly, you know, we don't really, it's not America. This is not America.
What? I thought this was America.
So we don't, oh, we just God. Don't really do kind of self-helpy stuff, or like really emotional, this kind of real, like, emotional revealing stuff. So I do feel a little bit like it's swimming upstream of cultural norms, but that didn't bother me enough to not do it. So,
and yeah. I mean, what's I don't know. I mean, the worst case scenario is you help some selves. Wouldn't that be dreadful? You're like, no, because I know for myself, even reading through it, I've just thought, oh, you know, like there have been several moments where it's really spoken to me quite deeply, and I've just thought,
oh, that's
yeah.
nice to hear.
Oh, it's bloody great. I love this book so much. And thank you for introducing me to the writing of Derek Jarman.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so happy to have another convert, because I can, as you can tell from this episode, I can rave about him for a long time.
I just think he's, I don't know, like, I don't know, I'm very excited. What, is there anything else? Is there anything we've missed that you need to...
Can I just say that Sarah Lang, among her, you know, manifold talents, a really funny and endearing thing she did for me is that she painted a picture of Derek Jarman as a, like, a Russian religious icon with, like, genuine gold leaf. It's really beautiful. So he looks awesome. Like a saint with a halo, you know. But even more hilariously, she painted me as like a little baby Jesus in the arms of Derek Jarman. So it's really odd. It's like this little baby. See, it's got my adult face on it. it's kind of the most marvelous and odd piece of art. I love it so much. And yeah, maybe we can put a photo of it beside this episode or something.
That'd be so great.
So yeah, you know, it's great when your friend, you've got creative friends who get how geeky you are about someone and can make these weird dreams come true for you. Like, I've got, obviously I never met Derek Jarman and I never will, but I have this piece of art where I'm cradled in his arms.
It's a really good focus. I was just thinking, what a wonderful place for all of us to be, cradled in the arms of the people we respect.
Yeah, and our creative heroes.
Our creative heroes. It's so great.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Oh, it's so great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pip. That was really fun.
You rock.
Thank you.